Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery bringing you this week's local government report. The Ramona Water District Board is trying to oust one of its elected members. Last year, the board voted to change its meeting time from 4:30 to 2 o'clock. But Director Kit Kessinger was absent and says he can't attend meetings so early in the day. He wants the board to change the time back to 4:30 p.m. when more members of the public can also attend. But the board has refused. Now, Kessinger has missed 7 meetings over the past 90 days, and his fellow directors have asked Board President Daryl Beck to draft a letter of reprimand and ask for Kessinger's resignation. Backers of Kessinger say the board engineered the time change to stifle an underdog who has questioned backroom deals, posts on the Ramona Sentinel website indicate. Ramona resident Don Kettick stated, "No one who's paying the water district bills can make a meeting at that time. We're all working. The meeting should be at 7 p.m. The Ramona Water District is clearly in need of having the light of truth shone upon them." In El Cajon, the City Council will consider an ordinance to restrict alcohol sale at its next meeting on August 27th. The law would not affect restaurants or bars, but it would restrict alcohol sales at future stores and would also require current stores to comply with the law. Violators would receive warnings and small fines initially, but could be shut down if serious violations occur repeatedly. New, smaller stores selling alcohol could only open in areas of the city with lower crime rates and where the state rules say there is room for more alcohol sales. Currently, the only areas that meet those requirements are Fletcher Hills and Granite Hills. The law would not apply to large stores that have less than 10% of store space set aside for alcohol sales, such as supermarkets and drugstores. You can post comments on the proposed law on the city's website. The issue is expected to be heard by El Cajon Council next Tuesday. Check the city website Monday when a final agenda should be posted.
This is Iris Neal. Join us for Job Talks, bringing you news about great jobs and growing our regional economy.
Job Talks on KNSJ's East County Magazine show is supported by our listeners and by the nonprofit San Diego Building Trades Family Housing Corporation, building our future.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting for Iris Neal. And today I am here with 3 newsmakers who are going to be telling us about a very exciting new program to help young people in our region, bringing job training and opportunities for high school degrees to the people of our region. My first guest is Dr. Mark Hansen, who is the executive director of the Heartland Coalition, which also, full disclosure, they are the parent nonprofit for East County Magazine. Heartland has a mission of providing win-win opportunities, including good jobs, capable employees, and sustainable communities in our region. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you very much, Miriam, and thank you for all the wonderful work you've done with East County Magazine. We're really proud of you and all the good things it does for everyone in the county.
We're certainly very appreciative as well for all of the support that Heartland has given us through the years. Tell us about the big announcement, this Heartland Youth Build Program, and what that's all about.
Yeah, that's about, again, our mission on good jobs and sustainable communities. And not only can the youth get a high school diploma, but also there'll be opportunities to learn trades, construction, of course, but we emphasize green construction, part of our sustainability mission in wind, solar, and weatherization, and also advanced manufacturing. So that's something that is very, very important to us. And
now you have an orientation coming up on August 24th, I understand.
Ignacio Jimenez will tell us a bit about that.
So this is actually a charter school that's being started up in City Heights, although I understand that it's open to young people 18 through 24 from throughout the region. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It'll be in the eastern region of City Heights. It will be very accessible. In the future, there'll be some activities that are now being planned in terms of manufacturing, construction of a home in East County and Spring Valley, manufacturing in El Cajon. A lot
Fantastic.
Of it will be tying into East
Construction
County.
Construction trades, but, learning right. that. Our next guest is Ignacio Jimenez, who is a counselor at the new school. And he is going to tell us about the program, which is affiliated actually with Youth Build programs at the national and state level, a little bit about the success there and who is eligible for the program and what you might expect if you go through the program there.
Thank you for having me, Miriam. Yes, this opportunity, it's going to be about obtaining a high school diploma with a leadership component and vocational training. It's open to the 16 to 24-year-olds from our communities, and it's very important that we understand that there's a major need, and we are looking to serve at least 80 students, and it's going to be very small classrooms. All the teachers that have been hired are experienced, dedicated, motivated teachers that have worked with the community of need, including the youth, at risk, and low income. But it's open to anybody in the vicinity.
So if you're a high school dropout, a veteran, immigrant, certainly many refugees in that community.
Yes,
how about
ma'am.
Someone who's maybe had issues in their past, a parolee, for example?
They're welcome to attend our orientation. And then we have what's called a mental toughness orientation. And that includes a one-week interview that would provide you an opportunity to find out if you're a good fit, and then if you're willing to do the work and the academics and be a leader and be goal-oriented, you're more than welcome to attend orientation coming up. I have a Saturday orientation of August the 24th, and the final orientation would be Wednesday, August the 28th. All of them are going to be at the 5280 Orange Avenue.
Very good. Now, there is a social justice component to this school, interestingly enough, which certainly fits with the Network for Social Justice that is KNSJ's motto. My next guest is Marquise Anderson, who is one of the instructors at the school. He teaches social studies and history, and he comes at it from a little bit different perspective. Marquise, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. My name is Marquise Anderson. I'm going to be one of the teachers at the Youth Build School with Heartland Coalition.
How do you motivate students who may have dropped out before, were not sufficiently motivated to finish the first time around? What do you do that's different to inspire these kids to want to finish?
Well, the primary thing that we're going to do is we're going to actually do an investigation of the community. So we're going to ask the students how their community functions, what their community needs, what the different identities of people in the community are, and then we're going to come together and do a forum. The way that we're going to try to motivate students is by making the education process about them. So we're not just saying this happened this year or this war or this battle. We're actually going to find out about their lives and use that to situate the curriculum. Okay. So we're going to teach to the needs and the interests of students.
Very interesting. Now, you mentioned to me out in the lobby before the interview that you are also coming at this from a social justice perspective when you teach history. How do you do that? Can you give me some examples?
Right. So we want to address some of the inequities and issues in the community that cause problems, but we also want to figure out a way to help the people of the community be self-sufficient and sustainable. So we want them to figure out how to solve these problems themselves. So we want to talk about the injustices that they might face.
And the historical injustices
such as poverty, you know, racism for women, gender issues.
So the social justice movements of the past,
such as the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. The labor movement. So we want to talk about those things. In fact, in the MC3 multi-craft core curriculum, there's actually a component. So the multi-craft core curriculum is a program to certify students to go into the trades. So there's actually a curriculum or a program for them to understand the history of the labor movement. So it covers things such as the labor movement over the century, labor leaders, the Industrial Revolution, agrarian to industrial production, and the history of craft workers in the United States.
Fascinating. Ignacio, can you tell us a little bit more about the trainings that you have coming up, the orientations and so forth, and how people can get more information about this?
I'd like to add to that is that we are a project-based campus rooted on social justice with the ideas that our students will be able to graduate and obtain good-paying jobs or continue a post-secondary opportunity or maybe even start their own business.
Where can people get more information about this and where exactly will the school be located?
The school is located at 5280 Orange Avenue, San Diego, California, 92105.
And that's City Heights area, I believe, across from the community center.
Our direct line is area code 619-436-9508, or by email, it'd be ijimenez@youthbuildcharter.org.
And that's Jimenez, J-I-M-E-N-E-Z, so I-J-I-M-E-N-E-Z heartlandcoalition.org. You will also soon be able to find information at the Heartland Coalition website, which is www.heartlandfdn.org. And we will certainly have a link to that as well at www.eastcountymagazine.org. I'd like to thank all of you for coming out today, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Miriam. And one more thing that I'd like to add is that this is all the educational programs are provided by our partner, which is Youth Build Charter School of California. And it's an opportunity to really create a new paradigm shift in the way we approach education. And thank you for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. Marquise, what final words do you have for us today?
So we run in trimesters, the program, and at the end of each trimester, there's a culminating project. So as Ignacio said, we're a project-based learning program. So what we do is we build throughout the trimester, and there's different components, there's different mini projects that culminate to a final project at the end of each trimester.
Thank you. Mark, is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know?
Yeah, it's important that they know it's a rolling enrollment, so they can roll it at various times. They don't have to wait for a new trimester. And another thing they might want to know is they can actually get a year and a half credit in 1 year. It's an intensified program.
Very good. That's wonderful to know. Well, we certainly look forward to hearing more about the program and bringing our listeners some updates as this gets rolling. Thank you so much for joining us today.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. My guest today is Carl Calvert from the Board of Directors of the Motor Transport Museum in Campo. Carl is leading the museum's extraordinary effort to restore four of the original buildings at Camp Lockett, a leading California state historic park and a central part of America's military history. Carl Calvert, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Helen.
Now, the Motor Transport Museum is an all-volunteer group, and yet you went out and you purchased four buildings at Camp Lockett. And why did you do that? What is the significance?
We needed more space to store our vehicles in that was covered and enclosed. Most of our vehicles are kept outside. We're open to the public, and they come in and wander around and look at our vehicles outside. But in our efforts to continue to preserve these vehicles, we can preserve them much better if they're inside. And by purchasing these buildings and putting them in use again, then we can put some of the vehicles inside the building.
So in other words, you're going to become a permanent caretaker.
Yes.
Of a very important site. The county
right.
must be delighted.
Yes, the county previously owned the buildings, and they were not using them. They were declining in condition. They were boarded up. They even appeared to be blighted because they were not in use. And our interest in these buildings wasn't just to keep vehicles and collections inside of them, but it was also to be able to see them reused again and restore them and rehabilitate the buildings. So,
what was the original use of the four buildings that you purchased?
The Army built them in 1941. There was originally 25 of these buildings in Campo that housed the horses for the cavalry. The Army had a number of cavalry posts across the United States, but they wanted one in the western part of the country here, so they built this camp called Camp Lockett in 1941 to house the soldiers that later became known as the Buffalo Soldiers. And
the famous African-American
that's
Buffalo Soldiers.
Yes. Okay. And it turned out to be the last cavalry camp that the government had. Other ones were disbanded in earlier years, but this managed to survive. After the use as a cavalry, the county bought the camp. They were originally used as horse stable buildings for Camp Lockett. There was 25 of them originally, and only four remain. But they kept the horses in these buildings. There was up to 58 horses kept in each one of the buildings. There was about 3,000 horses at this camp at one time.
My goodness.
Quite a few horses out there. The cavalry that was at Camp Lockett, they housed the African-American soldiers there, and they later became known as the Buffalo Soldiers, very famous soldiers.
Yes.
And they trained them on how to use horses, and there was large fields there in the area where every day they would take the horses out and train the troops on how to care for the horses and train them on how to use them.
Carl, I've seen these buildings. There's a forest of lumber in there. Back in the day when they used whole tree trunks to make beams and ceilings.
Yes, yes.
They're quite extraordinary looking. Do you hold a giant fundraiser? Are you getting any help for this big project?
Yes, we are getting some help for it. The county has been extremely helpful. We've applied, for example, this last year, we applied for 3 different grants. We were able to get approval on 2 of them. And we're slowly working on the buildings. The first thing we needed to do was replace the roofs to help preserve these buildings so they wouldn't leak. And we finished the first building, and we're now working on the second building with a brand new roof. And it's mostly volunteer labor that's working with me to rehab these buildings.
My goodness. Yeah. So you have a lot of skilled people with contract skills.
Yes, our membership is quite varied. People from all different trades that we have, electricians, contractors, and people that are members of the museum.
Is the U.S. government aware of what you're doing?
I don't know that the U.S. government is. We applied for a U.S. government grant, and we were not successful in obtaining that. We've been more successful in getting grants on a local level.
Well, that's very heartening news. Do you have plans to open the 4 former stable buildings?
Yes, we do eventually.
Certain?
Yes.
Okay.
Once we get the roofs on them, we will address other issues like the electric windows. A lot of the windows were broken. They were vandalized at one point, and people broke the glass out of the windows, and we'll replace the doors. But essentially, we're trying to rehabilitate these buildings so they look from the outside as they did originally, as much as possible. The inside has been changed a little bit because after the Army used the buildings, the county bought them, and they leased them to the Mountain Empire School District, and they put junior high and high school facilities inside the buildings, and that's where many of the local people went to school there years ago.
Then you must be making a lot of people in Campo very happy.
Oh, we are. Right. We get a lot of accolades, yes.
Carl, this is an extraordinary story, and I want to thank you for stopping by, and I hope you'll come again because we want to learn more about the Motor Transport Museum.
Good. It's
thank
my pleasure,
you.
Helen.
And thank you for listening to The Sounds of History. I'm Helen Ofield.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ and East County Magazine bringing you a breaking news bulletin. David Bittner from the Wildlife Institute in Ramona, the eagle expert whose research was used to justify building several major wind energy projects and the Sunrise Power Link, has been sentenced in federal court for illegally taking eagles and repeatedly failing to turn in data on birds of prey that he banded and fitted with transmitters. The federal prosecutor argued that Bittner was more concerned about his own economic gain than the birds' well-being. Bittner was fined just $5,000 and granted probation, under condition that he turn over years of missing data to the government. Donna Tisdale, a representative of Protect Our Communities Foundation that is sued to block wind projects that relied on Bittner's data, praised the Justice Department for prosecuting Bittner. However, she believes the sentence was not severe enough. She said, "When unethical and basically corrupt experts like Bittner side with industry over avian protection, our beautiful birds literally get clobbered with the blunt end of the turbine blade." Bittner has been paid more than $600,000 in consulting fees from corporations, including Sempra Energy, Iberdrola Renewables, and Pattern Energy. He provided study data to the companies, but refused to turn it over to the government. Those reports were used to justify building Ocotillo Wind and the planned Tule Wind Project in McCain Valley in East County, as well as the Energia Sierra Juarez Wind Project in northern Baja, Mexico. In each of these projects, Bittner concluded that the wind turbines would not pose serious threats to eagles, although portions of these projects have long been considered eagle habitat. The sentencing memorandum reveals that Bittner had a long history of noncompliance with federal and state laws in multiple states. According to some witnesses cited in the memorandum, 90% of eagles fitted by Bittner with transmitters died within one 9-month period. Other experts said there was no scientifically valid reason for attaching two transmitters to certain birds. Bittner previously had his license revoked by state and federal authorities in Ohio after he was convicted of illegally taking turkey eggs and arrested for possessing birds of prey without a permit. And yet he continued to illegally catch and band birds. He lied to probation officials and falsely claimed recently that this was the only time his permit had lapsed in 48 years. In fact, he had no active permit for 17 years from 1980 to 1997, the government contends. He reactivated his permit after moving to Ramona, but has had no valid permit in California since 2000 due to failing to turn in much of the required data. This includes data on dozens of eagles tagged and fitted with transmitters in San Diego and Imperial counties. Bittner has also been illegally using wild raptors or birds of prey in educational programs that are open to the public at his Wildlife Institute in Ramona, which hosts the popular Hawk Watch program each year. In addition, he was found to illegally possess four freezers full of dead birds, including migratory birds and golden eagles, some dating back years. In addition, Bittner conducted a helicopter survey of eagle nests in Joshua Tree National Monument, even after being denied a permit for use of helicopter due to fears by authorities of disturbing the birds. Bittner has balked at turning over transmitter data to the government, claiming this is proprietary information to be shared only with his corporate clients. He has claimed he had no time to apply for the required permits, though a wildlife biologist, Edie Harmon, has informed East County Magazine that the process is not time-consuming. Bittner's lawyer claimed he wants to retire and seeks to protect the birds and does not want the public to know where nests could be. His attorney also contended that no birds have been harmed by his efforts. That point was flatly disputed by prosecutor Melanie Pearson with the U.S. Attorney's Office, who said that birds have been harmed by Bittner. Even after pleading guilty to federal charges, Bittner sent a fundraising letter to donors asking them to support his nonprofit Wildlife Research Institute's education programs and eagle research to help agencies, quote, make sound scientific decisions regarding wind, solar, and other development projects. His fundraising letter to donors failed to disclose his guilty plea on federal charges or his lack of permits to conduct eagle research or even operate the educational facility. Bittner told East County Magazine that he did submit data on 600 bands more than what the authorities have on record. He said he and his wife raised funds to buy Ramona grasslands and sell the property to the Nature Conservancy as raptor habitat, where bald eagles are nesting. Despite pleading guilty to the federal charges, however, he insisted that, quote, everything we do is standard operating procedure. After his sentencing hearing, Donna Tisdale, who also chairs the Boulevard Community Planning Group in the area where Tule Wynn is planned, said that it's time for agencies that approved this project and others relying on Bittner's research to re-examine their findings. She concluded, perhaps it is time to review all his material and its validity.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Ken Culkin. My guest is an award-winning author of 10 books and recipient of a National Endowment of the Arts Fellowship. Ken's writing has also appeared in dozens of magazines, including Esquire, Best American Short Stories, and the San Diego Reader. Welcome, Ken. It's a pleasure to see you.
Hello. It's nice to be here.
Ken, you have a long history of writing everything from columns to short stories to your own novels, as well as mysteries co-authored with local writer Alan Russell. Which projects would you say that you enjoy the most and why?
The biggest amount of time that I've spent, and so I just enjoy writing. So my primary project over the years for about the last 20 years, actually, has been a series that began with a book called The Loud Adios. That's A-D-I-O-S, like in Spanish, only usually the accent mark is left off by mistake. From there, it just sort of transformed itself into a series in which I am able to explore this character, this Tom Hickey fellow, all the way from his childhood all the way until he is a very old man, and also his family, his son and his adopted son and his two wives and other historical characters all factor into different novels. And so I get to explore these characters, and they grow in my mind, and my knowledge about the historical characters grow a lot. So I just get a kick out of learning about the history of California, which is where they're all set, over the 20th century. And I just love dealing with the characters and the history.
So you're learning more about the real world and the world you created.
Both, yeah. I'm not sure that they're different, but sometimes they run together.
They merge.
Yes.
Your book, In Writing and the Spirit, offers guidance and inspiration to other writers. What would you say is your main advice, and have you received any feedback from the San Diego writing community about it?
My main advice is to read the book, because there's a whole lot of stuff in there, and I can't say that any one piece of advice is right for everybody by any means, because the feedback that I've gotten, and I certainly have gotten quite a bit from San Diego and elsewhere, is that this part really spoke to me. It's a sort of a series of meditations, just a couple of pages long, mm-hmm. that offer, you know, different insights into the subject of mostly about inspiration and how we can get inspired, and how we can open our minds and free our minds and be ready to listen to the muse or the spirit or whatever we want to call it.
What inspires you? How do you listen to the muse?
The example that comes most readily to mind this morning, I get a lot of ideas in the bathtub, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, which is why I generally take baths instead of showers. And also on walks. But this morning I realized there's a character named Leslie White, who was an actual detective investigator for the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office. And he just plays a very bit part, because I wanted to get in some information. And he was a good guy to give this information.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have another character that I have been wondering what to do with. He's somebody that's following Tom Hickey throughout the novel, and sometimes following his sister, Florence. So I didn't know who he was following and why he was doing this, and so I hadn't dealt with that yet. But it occurred to me this morning that he's following him at the behest of this fellow, Leslie White. So although Tom, well, I'm not going to go into what happens beyond that, because I would give some stuff away. I don't want to. But the one thing led to another. The character led me to Leslie White, which led me to the reason why this guy is following him, and it opened up some distinct possibilities that could answer some questions about some thorny problems that I still have to solve in the novel.
So it's like unraveling a ball of string.
Mm-hmm. And it all fell together in about 10 different pieces from one particular idea.
What fun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, going back to the mysteries that you co-authored with Alan Russell, I know they have the intriguing titles of Roadkill and No Cats, No Chocolate, and that they're about the madness of book tours. Is there a story behind the story? I mean, are book tours really mad?
Well, book tours are mad when Alan and I are on them. I'm not sure that everybody else is quite as mad as we are, but we're both pretty ornery, and we like to argue. And and if anything is tedious, then our imaginations spring to life, and no telling what could happen. So they're very mad. But a story that I like to tell is when the title, No Cats, No Chocolate, came from a book signing we were doing. It was in Boulder, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And the bookseller said, hey, would you guys like to make some money, big money? And we said, well, yeah, you know, we're not, you know. And he said, write a book called The Cat Who Would Die for Chocolate, because cats and chocolate were big in the mystery genre at the time. Well, Alan and I thought of ourselves as a step above writers who would capitalize on such mundane stuff as mm-hmm. chocolate and cats. And we didn't see ourselves as commercial as all that. So we decided to write this book and go the absolute opposite way and call it No Cats, No Chocolate. Now, recently, it was quite a bestseller on Amazon in an ebook. We were number one in the Oprah category.
Wow.
and in the Midwest travel and in the West Coast travel, because we're on our way to be on Oprah in one of the books, and then No Cats, No Chocolate. So what we did when we were promoting the book is we asked a bunch of writer friends to write the nastiest comments they could possibly write about us. And so they did. So we have a lot of famous writers that are saying just awful things about how degraded and what reprobates we are. So when a lot of people started reading that book, I got notes from friends that were just lamenting the fact that these people would have such awful things to say about us. So I really got a kick out of that, because I had not realized that anybody was quite capable of thinking that an author, if they got comments like that, would actually put it in their book. So I was baffled and a bit chagrined by the fact that I think I don't know as much about the human mind as I thought I did before that, if they're capable of making that mistake. So.
Well, it sounds like you have a great time overall with this.
I do. I love it.
So last question, what is your next writing project and when do you think we'll see it?
Well, I'm hoping it'll be out in spring with Poison Pen Press. It's called The Good Know Nothing, and it's the second chronologically and the seventh actual book of the Hickey family series that I mentioned. It involves the Sundance Kid and Tom Hickey, of course, and it's set in 1936, right during mm-hmm. the Nazi Olympics. It also features B. Traven, that wrote The Treasure of Sierra Madre, and Wave Randolph Hearst and Marion Davies. And there's some other celebrity. Amy mm-hmm. Semple McPherson factors into it, the old-time preacher. So I'm just having fun. And now that I've solved these things that I solved this morning because of that one idea leading to others, I should be done with it sometime in July, and it should come out next spring.
Okay, well, we look forward to seeing it. Our time is up, Ken, but thanks again for joining us. For more information on Ken Culkin, and that's K-U-H-L-K-E-N, please visit his website at www.kenculkin.net. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
Thank you.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
San Diego Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez has announced a plan to introduce legislation this week to prevent payment for immigration reform services until the federal immigration reform is enacted, and to ensure that other consumer protections are provided to immigrants pursuing a pathway to U.S. citizenship under the pending Federal Immigration Reform Act in Congress. She says, as millions of California families face the historic opportunity of improving their lives by pursuing a pathway to citizenship, the state must be ready to ensure immigration services are performed by competent professionals and include anti-fraud protections. Assemblywoman Gonzalez added, AB 1159 prepares California for this upswing in demand by creating more accountability and transparency in an otherwise daunting process for immigrants who are already targets of fraud now. AB 1159 will be considered this week by the Senate Committee on Business, Professions, and Economic Development. Assemblywoman Gonzalez has asked that the legislature act with urgency, requiring a higher vote threshold, in order to crack down on unscrupulous practices by some professionals who are demanding payment for immigration reform services and promising that clients could cut to the front of the line when the federal immigration reforms are enacted, if they pay now. AB 1159's goal of empowering immigrants during their pursuit of citizenship by prohibiting anyone who is not an attorney from presenting themselves as one will also make it illegal for attorneys or consultants to demand money from clients seeking Immigration Reform Act services before the federal reform is enacted. The bill will also require immigration consultants to deposit into a client trust account all funds received from a client of immigration reform services prior to performing the services. Attorneys and consultants must also provide a client with a written contract in the client's language with specified requirements in that contract. AB 1159 increases the required bond for consultants performing Immigration Reform Act services to $100,000 and allows immigrants to recover damages related to immigration fraud. The bill has gained early support from the State Bar of California, labor groups, faith-based organizations, and groups dedicated to advocating for immigrant rights and equitable access to justice, Assemblywoman Gonzalez says.
But all I know is this feels right when we're under the stars tonight. These butterflies that I can't fight, so I'll just let them fly.
It's Leon Thompson, and I'm here with Raylene Nicole, a promising young musician from East County. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you. Yeah, so I grew up my whole life in East County, my whole 18 years of life. We've moved around a lot, but basically it's been the same two freeway exits the whole time. I went to elementary school, middle school, Blossom Valley and then Las Coches Creek. And then I went to high school, Granite Hills, and I just graduated.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, I first heard you at the Coyote Music Festival at Cuyamaca College. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was a really fun experience. That was the first music festival I've ever been a part of. And I had no idea that I was actually going to be in that. And one day I was at Starbucks in Rancho San Diego. They have an open mic. So I was at the open mic. Then I happened to walk in to grab a Starbucks. And on the little bulletin board, they had like a little flyer saying, oh, musicians need it. I'm like, oh, that's me. I think it was a website. And I looked on and it was the music festival. And I'm like, that would be super cool. And they were having tryouts. So I went to the tryouts. And it was really intimidating because I walked in and I was still a senior in high school. So it's all these college kids in this big, giant, like, performance hall, so, like, with a stage and chairs, like, theater looking. And so I was on the stage all by myself, me and my guitar, and then all these people in the seats. Part of their class was to judge the auditions. So they're all staring at me with papers, writing down notes. I had no idea what they were writing. And they're all looking up at me every now and then. So, and then I started playing, and one guy in the front, I remember, was, like, dancing to it. So I felt a lot better. I was like, okay, they like it. I'm not going to die. So, and then I think they emailed me or called me back. They really liked your audition. We'd like to have you play at the festival. So my drummer, Chemo, and I just got together, practiced a little bit, came up with the set, and then we got to play. And it was so much fun. It was the coolest thing. It was, you know, it was a really nice day. So everyone was out there on blankets, like with picnics, and there was like tons of little booths around. And I think it was only their second or third annual. It was really new. So I'm sure it's going to even get bigger and bigger every year. So the students were running everything. That's a really cool class, you know, to teach kids to run a festival. That's something that you don't learn every day. There was a lot of other musicians and bands, and they had face painting. I got to get my face painted and snow cones and just little vendors and everything. So it was a really cool way to bring the whole college area community together.
Speaking of your music, how would you describe it?
I would describe my music as like a relaxing summer playlist, you know, when you're driving in the car. I have some upbeat songs that really get people going. I'm a typical teenage girl, so what else am I going to write about rather than, you know, the boy I have a crush on or something. So a lot of my songs are about that kind of feeling when you don't really know the person too well, but you can't wait to see what happens in the future. And I think that's one of the funnest feelings ever, is like the feeling of possibility or who knows what's going to come. You know, I really like this guy and he, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but I like him. That's all I know. I have a couple other ones. They're also upbeat. And I'm trying to write more of these songs lately because it's how I feel. And it's more just about believing in yourself and not really listening to negative people or, you know, just positive sort of things and just about good feelings and sounds like rainbows, butterflies kind of thing. But, you know, I like that. So I like inspiring people to believe in themselves and go for what they really want to do rather than just be sad. But then on the other hand, I do have a couple sad songs that are extremely sad. So, but I think that's kind of what I like to make myself relatable, saying, you know, I understand how they feel, or like certain feelings that people don't like to touch on. But if the lyrics can understand how they're feeling, I think people like that and they'll relate to that and want to listen to that more. Yeah.
Can you do one of your songs for us?
Yes, I can. Is that the one
Pouring
I
Pouring Down?
Yes, I can.
All right. Thank you. Let's hear that.
So much more I haven't told you. There's so much more that you don't know. And everything's so new, but just trust me and I'll trust you. I've still got so much more of me to show. You've got those eyes that make me wonder. I wonder if you feel the way I do. Now I can't concentrate and it's your fault. I can't think straight, just tell me if your hands are shaking too. We're not too sure about anything, but honestly for me, that's okay. Kiss me in the rain out where it's pouring down, but I don't care, I'm giving up and I'm so scared to let you in. But all I know is this feels right when we're under the stars tonight. These butterflies that I can't fight, so I'll just let them fly. How come everything's so beautiful? beautiful when I'm with you. The way we laugh on accident. I think I'm going under as we dance to the flash of thunder. We're so cool, we won't go inside just yet. We're not too sure about anything. But honestly, for me, that's okay. You kiss me in the rain, I'll wear it. Pouring down, but I don't care. I'm giving up and I'm so scared to let you in. But all I know is this feels right when we're under the stars tonight. These butterflies that I can't fight, so I'll just let them fly. Don't think about butterflies that I can't fight, so I'll just let them fly.
Well, thank you, Rayleigh.
You're welcome.
So what's coming up in your career? What is next for Rayleigh?
The next thing I really want to do is record a full album, 12-song album, mix of, you know, happy and sad ones. I still need a couple more songs before I do that, but I want to record that album, kind of tour around the country, kind of the poor musicians tour where I, you know, get in my own car and drive around, but hey, a tour is a tour. Just spread the music and see, you know, how far I can get it to go.
How did you get your musical training?
I have been taking piano lessons ever since I was 5 years old, and then I went all the way until high school started, so up till I was 15, so it was 10 years of piano lessons, and then I did, I think, like a week or two of vocal lessons when I was in middle school or something, and I didn't like it very much, and then even back then, I wasn't trying to sing, I just went to lessons just because, but I never really started singing until after my freshman year in high school, and that's when I started playing guitar as well, because my grandparents got me a guitar for Christmas during my freshman year, and then I didn't really do much with it. I learned a couple chords, and then that was that, and then after my freshman year of high school, during that summer, I think I put up my first YouTube video and all my friends were like, oh my God. Now I look back on it and I'm like, oh, that was not very good at all. But back then, I mean, I got tons of praise for it. So I was like, okay, if I can hide on the computer screen and they like it, now I can go in person and maybe they'll like it too. So I started to play covers at local coffee shops and things like that in South Park and North Park, City Heights area. I started writing originals and playing those. And then that got me to go up and produce the EP and everything. And I never took any guitar lessons. It was really just, if you really, really want to learn something, you'll figure out a way to teach yourself. You will learn it. And especially today with the internet, it was so easy. I was on YouTube all the time. UltimateGuitar.com was a blessing because once you learn how to read, because I used the book to teach myself to read chords and tab. And then once I could do that, I could get on Ultimate Guitar. And then each song had chords and tabs with it. And I was like, okay, well, now I can play the song. I would play it like 5 hours a day, like so much. And so I think I learned quickly. It kind of kickstarted a lot of time. I compacted it into one summer. But yeah, I never took lessons. I just used YouTube videos and online everything. So.
We're really glad that you did.
Thanks.
your voice is lovely and sweet.
Thank you.
And I like your chord progressions and changes and the range. It's beautiful. So we
Thank
really
you so
appreciate
much.
You coming in
Thank
and
you.
Talking to us.
Thanks.
We've been speaking to Raylee Nicole. So how can people reach you if they want to hear some more of your music?
Well, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all those social network things that everyone likes to go on. Just look up Raylee Nicole, which is R-A-E-L-E-E. That's Raylee. And then Nicole is N-I-K-O-L-E. And then I have a website, www.rayleenicole.com, www.rayleenicole.com.
Thank you so much, Raylee.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery, and my guest today is Rick Halsey, who is the director of the Chaparral Institute. Welcome, Rick.
Hi, Miriam.
In recent years, controlled burns have been a major part of California's strategy for preventing wildfires. But now, the Chaparral Institute has completed a study which had some interesting findings suggesting this may not be the best strategy. Rick, tell us what you concluded.
The most pervasive perspective most people have, in fact, you see it in every newspaper article about fires, is that fire suppression in the past by firefighters has allowed an unnatural amount of vegetation to grow up throughout the entire state. So when you have these big fires, it's always blamed on past fire suppression efforts. And basically what you're saying is the firefighters are the ones that caused the problem that they're trying to extinguish. And the data now that we've collected, there's been five major research papers done by different scientists over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And we've done a significant review of those papers. And consistently what they've all found is that fire suppression in shrubland ecosystems, now we're talking about chaparral, coastal sage scrub.
So not necessarily pine forest,
right,
but chaparral specifically.
Which are the most dominant ecosystems in California. Mm-hmm. In Southern California, those ecosystems are not impacted at all by fire suppression. In other words, the amount of vegetation out there is a natural byproduct of their natural processes.
So a controlled burn does not help to prevent fire. Can it make it worse?
Yes. The problem we're seeing right now is there are so many fires on the landscape, more fires than the ecosystems can tolerate, which is also contrary to what most people believe, is that if you add more fire to the landscape in the form of a controlled burn, for example, like they did in the San Felipe Valley this last May.
Which was a controlled burn that quickly got out of control. I believe it burned 3,000 acres. It was only supposed to burn 100.
Yeah, a couple thousand acres there. And what happened was, the wind picked up and it took off. That area had been burned by the 2002 Pines fire. And so you had a repeat fire frequency here of a little more than 10 years. The ecosystem cannot tolerate that kind of fire return interval. And what happens is the shrubs, the ecosystem itself can't recover. And so there's not enough seeds in the soil. The underground burrows for the plants don't have enough starch to resprout. So something has to fill the void. And ultimately what that is weeds.
So you get grasses coming
yes.
up where you used to have shrubs, chaparral, bushes, and other things.
Exactly. And those weeds are much more flammable. They extend this fire season by several months. So what you've done, you replaced one form of quote-unquote fuel with another form, which is much more flammable. In fact, it's the most dangerous kind of fire you can have as a grass fire. The fire that's spreading up in the Banning area this week here has been spreading at 1,000 acres an hour, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that area had burned in the 2006 Esperanza fire. Well, what's really been filling in the void up there is grasses, and grasses burn so fast.
And yet CAL FIRE has proposed to dramatically increase controlled burns. Do you happen to have the statistics on that?
Well, they are basically, with this new proposal, targeting a third of the entire state of California for what they call vegetation treatment.
Third of the state, that is astounding.
They're not going to actually do a third, but that's what's in their sights. So
potentially.
Yes. The problem with this is they've decided to basically treat all of California, all ecosystems, as if they're forests, when in fact the highest fire danger and the highest fire risk in California are in shrublands in Southern California. You cannot treat them like forests. It's a whole different ecosystem.
Why are chaparral ecosystems important for our region and for our environment?
Chaparral is probably, I think, the closest, most intact place you can experience nature for most Californians. It's right next door. It's in the park nearby. And it's really a beautiful wildlife-intensive area that people can go out and enjoy the natural environment.
How would these controlled burns impact wildlife? That seems like an awfully large number of acres of a particular habitat to burn.
Well, once you burn an area, if it's been repeatedly burned in the past, ultimately you remove all the biodiversity and you replace it with a weed patch. And so you'll get some grasshoppers and maybe a few coyotes running through, but you've effectively destroyed the source that allows the biodiversity to exist.
Now, you presented your research, I understand, at a California Board of Forestry hearing, CAL FIRE, August 8th up in Ventura. How did that go?
We had a representative there at the hearing, and the Board of Forestry right now is reviewing the proposal to do this targeted vegetation treatment plan, and there was public testimony, and we were there, presented documents, and we also gave a full report on our San Felipe escape fire report.
Mm-hmm. What was the reaction that was received?
Well, when you talk to a board of any kind, it's typically pretty benign, and there's not much reaction, and that was up there as well, from my understanding. But a lot of information was passed along, and we're hoping the board will continue its effort to collaborate with all the fire scientists, all the natural history experts, the environmental groups, because fire is a statewide issue, and it involves right. all of us. And so all of us need to be involved in trying to resolve the issue.
Have you met with elected officials on your findings?
Yes, I've. We've pretty much met with everybody, and it's.
Is there anyone who's taking this up or championing this cause?
Politically, no. It seems to be left to the agencies for the most part. Unfortunately, when big fires occur, there's a big interest level and money's thrown at the problem. And the problem is most of the time what they do is just try to fund vegetation treatment projects, which we've been doing for the last 100 years.
Is it a penny-wise, pound-foolish thing, do you think, in this era of budget cuts where we've seen firefighting budgets cut? Are they thinking this is just, you know, a cheaper way to forestall this?
It's politically the most effective way to go about it, but it's not the most effective way to do it.
To prevent. In other words, they may just be setting us up for larger and more expensive fires down the road.
Well, what happens, you have to ask the question, what are you trying to do when you're talking about reducing fire risk? You're trying to protect lives and property. So how do you do that? And the research has clearly shown the best way to do that is to fire-harden communities, which means retrofit structures that are not properly safe. For example, ember-resistant vents. Mm-hmm. Do proper defensible space, which does not mean 300 feet of clear-cut dirt. It means thinning the vegetation in a way that will allow the vegetation that's properly irrigated to act as an ember catcher and a heat sink. And so these areas that have cleared massive amounts of land around homes, often these places go up in smoke because they've created basically an alleyway for embers to fly and hit the house. So there's a whole sort of list of things you can do around, in, and on the communities themselves in order to make them fire safe. And that then becomes a permanent solution instead of going out in the landscape and continually whacking nature when, in fact, all it's going to do is going to create a weedy environment, which is even more flammable.
Very interesting. Now, where can people go to get more information about this, and are there any actions that you recommend folks who may be concerned about this issue could take?
Sure. We have a website. It's californiachaparral.org, and that's one P and two R's. Mm-hmm. You can type in California Chaparral, and ultimately you'll find the Institute's name there. So people can go to our website. It's www.california, all spelled out, Chaparral, that's C-H-A-P-A-R-R. AL.org. And that's the California Chaparral Institute's website. And we have a page specifically called Protecting Your Home, which has all the data, all the science, and a lot of resources for you to do the right thing.
Very good. Rick, thank you so much for being here and sharing this extremely important information with our listeners here on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso.
Thank you.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun.
I'd like to talk today about some trees that I absolutely love. And number one on that list is always and forever for me going to be the California live oaks. We're here in East County where the California live oaks are the most beautiful tree that we have. One live oak tree, mature, fully grown, can support up to 1,500 species of other life. They are so beautiful, so iconic, so much an important part of what we think we're seeing when we look at California. It's especially important to plant a live oak tree now because of the fact so many of the oldest of the trees out in the hills are being killed by the gold-spotted oak borer. That is a pest which is imported, and it is killing a lot of the old trees. But you can grow California live oaks on your property. What people don't understand is that's a fast-growing tree if you just hook it up to some irrigation while it's young. The first 10 years of life, you can water that tree year-round. You can put a dripper on it and walk away from it, let it get some water once a week, and it will grow to a 15 to 20-foot tree in just 10 years. And that's a good tree. That's a hardwood tree. That's not a junky tree like an ash. By the way, don't plant ash trees. There's a bad disease coming from back east, which is eventually going to kill all the ash trees in California, as it has all the ash trees from east of Ohio coming west. So plant yourself a beautiful California live oak. That wouldn't be limited to just the live oaks. If you live out in the back country, consider an Engelmann oak too. That was Kara Knott's favorite tree, and that is a beautiful tree. It's also known as a Mesa oak. It will take less water than the California live oak and do beautifully. Some other good trees, not all of them natives, that you could put in your yard. There are two great trees from Australia that do so well here. They're quick growing and they are great shade trees. They don't have any obnoxious habits. They don't have terrible roots. They don't drop a big mess. They're good trees. My favorite of them is called the peppermint tree or the peppermint willow tree. It's Agonis flexuosa. A-G-O-N-I-S, Agonis flexuosa. It's a beautiful tree. It has a natural weeping form, gets about 25 feet tall, maybe 15 feet wide, and grows very quickly. After a few years, you can shut the water off to it, and it'll make it on its own. It smells lovely, and it has the cutest flowers when it blooms. It hangs down something that looks like a black ribbon with little white flowers on it. The ribbon is maybe half an inch wide. It's really a cute tree. And everybody I know who's ever used it as a yard tree or on the side of the house has been delighted with it. A very similar tree is called the Australian willow, Geigera parviflora. It's about the same size. It's very drought tolerant. It's similar to the Agonis and a very popular small, non-messy tree. Now let's talk about a nice tree that's messy. What does that mean? Well, it means that it mulches itself. And since we want to mulch things here in East County, this is a great tree. It takes care of itself. It's an African sumac tree. You can see those in front of the El Cajon Library, all the way around the library. There's another one at the Rancho San Diego Library. That's the big tree that's kind of a dull green color out front, reddish bark. It's the first tree that I planted when I moved onto my property 13 years ago. It's very popular with birds. It grows with virtually no water once you get it established. After 2 years, shut the water off. It'll be fine on its own. That's a tree that if you prune it correctly while it's still a baby, it will grow the rest of its life for you, and you will never have to prune it again. Another small tree that's very pretty to put in your yard. Put in a bronze loquat. It's not a big tree. It'll never get over about 15 feet tall, maybe 12 feet wide, even if it's very successful. And the leaves are big and green and glossy, and it also bears fruit. Now, I personally don't care for the fruit. It has a big seed and kind of a weird orange fruit around it. It doesn't taste bad. It just doesn't seem to me worth the effort, but scrub jays adore it. I know that on my bronze loquat, I never get to eat the fruit because the birds find it before I do. So those are some ideas that you can try in your yard. And I think that all of these trees are basically pain-free. You won't be calling the pruning guy constantly to come and hack on it because these are good trees.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.